Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stinnett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stinnett. Today, we have a very special guest. We have Isaac Abbs from, he's the CIO at Pima College, and we are going to have a very fun conversation. So Isaac, I'm very excited to hear about your existing career and what you've done in education, along with technology. And then if we have some time, I think we're going to venture into our favorite topic, which is AI stuff. So would you like to give a quick introduction of yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Rochelle. Thanks, Drew. Thanks for having me this morning. Isaac Abbs, Assistant Vice Chancellor for IT and Chief Information Officer at Pima Community College in sunny Tucson, Arizona. Oversee a staff of about 100 for a college serving over about 30,000 individual students, about 11,000 full-time equivalents. So keeps us pretty busy.
I'll bet.
That's a big staff.
It really is. So tell me something. So has your demographics changed in light of COVID, or have you seen more or less change, or have you stayed consistent over time?
Within the IT department, we're actually fortunate to be pretty steady. I would say turnover in the IT staff is very low, which is a very positive thing at the moment. As an institution, that's a great question. So I came back to the college. I left about a year before COVID, came back a few years after COVID. In my time away, the college created a new strategic plan. That strategic plan has two very big goals. One is achieve 60, which is 60% of everybody in Pima County with some type of degree or certificate, I think by 2030. And the other one is to double the number of completers of Latino, Hispanics, Black, African-American, Native American. So the underserved population, double the number of the completers, I think by 2025. So pretty ambitious goal, but there is definitely a push at the institution to shift the demographics. We are an HSI, Hispanic Serving Institution, have been that for a while now. So yes, we are very passionate about our mission, our purpose, which is to, transform lives through affordable education, really focusing and making headway on the underserved population. So I think to some degree, you're seeing some shifts back from pre-pandemic. Unfortunately, typically African-American minority males have dropped off. And I think there's a big push to get them back. But overall, we're seeing upward momentum, not exponential, but we are seeing upward momentum.
That's wonderful. I think that there's a tremendous shift that we're seeing. So the PWIs seem to be pretty consistent. They haven't seen a tremendous drop off in enrollments. Like what we've seen at Duke and some of the other universities, their enrollments have actually, or I should say, requests to engage increase as opposed to decrease, where some of the other institutions, specifically those Learn in Your Pajama universities, have decreased enrollment. And you see a push specifically in television ads to get students to enroll in those. But I think the community colleges, the traditional community colleges and universities have stayed consistent. But I don't know if you follow the news, but here in North Carolina, one of our historically Black colleges is struggling to maintain their accreditation. Uh-huh. What's really interesting to see is what will happen to historically Black colleges, whereas North Carolina Central, here, I have 3 degrees from there, I'm a happy eagle. They have seen a transition to Hispanic or Latinx enrollments increase, uh-huh. So it's really interesting to see what the trajectory will be for minority serving colleges over time. And it's really wonderful to hear what you said, what you're doing, but for Black enrollments, it'll be really interesting to see what will happen in the next few years. So I'm really happy to hear what you have said. So that said, where do you see, talk to us a little bit about your career. So where did you start?
Yeah.
How did you begin in IT? What's your path?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's about, well, 21 years ago almost. So I graduated originally, so I grew up in California, originally started my college career up in Maine at Bates College, was there for about a year and a half, and it was a little small, a little away from home, and a little too cold. And so I made my way to the University of Arizona, graduated in 2003. I graduated with interdisciplinary studies in math, computer science, and Spanish. So that is when I embarked on my IT career, software developer by trade, and I went into local government. So I started with the city of Tucson. I was working in the clerk's office, so very heavily involved with elections, writing software, not for the elections, but to track, early ballot requests, poll center, supplies and whatnot. I was the sysadmin for the election system, so I was very heavily involved in administering elections from an IT capacity. Did that for 4.5 years. I think about 3 years into it is when I went back to school. So started working on my master's in management information systems for the from the University of Illinois at Springfield. About a year into that, I moved over to the city's IT department. That lasted about a year. I think it was a city and an organization very much in transition. So this is, about right before the downturn in the economy in 2008. So this was about 2007-ish, right? And so the city went from fat and happy to lean, and things are getting tough. But I got a good mentor, a really good mentor that year in IT, someone who believed in me and really understood what I wanted to do professionally and put me in positions to be successful. So a year after being in IT, there was an opening for an IT manager for the city court system. First IT manager ever for that group. And IT was centralizing across the city, but this was one of the few groups that was not centralizing. And so I threw my hat in the ring, and I will tell you, I was, I think, the only, and it was an internal only recruitment. So you had a lot of sitting managers who didn't want to be part of central IT throwing for this. And so I think five people went for it. I was the only one with no managerial experience, and I got the job. I don't know.
Nice.
Maybe I was the cheapest one. I don't know. The bottom line is, I got the job, and that was my first experience at 27, going into IT management, which I think really set the beginning of what I would say has become my career. I was the youngest person on the team, so that was quite the experience walking in, being the youngest one, and now being responsible for this group. And I think something I've learned along the way that you'll always experience, of course, one of the people on the team went for the job, didn't get the job. So you deal with that aspect of it. And I remember the first few weeks were tough, really tough. Because I wasn't like the new guy, I was the new guy and the boss. So right, I was pretty much the outsider. But I think something that I talk about a lot now, I don't know if I really understood it then, but when you get into management, you become less, you manage the technology less, and it's more about managing people. Like, I'm in the people business
Absolutely.
way more than I'm in the technology business now. I mean, I'm very
Absolutely.
heavily involved in the technology, don't get me wrong, but I deal with people way more. And so
Part of the job.
it's part of
Part
the
is part of the
job. It's
job.
like the job.
Yep.
So what I quickly realized, and my dad has been in management all my life, and I think intrinsically you can learn a lot. It's not like we've ever sat down and had this conversation, but as I, mature and advance in my career, I realize how much I learned, I think, through observation growing up. But I think the biggest breakthrough moment is when I sat down with each of the staff members one-on-one for about an hour and just had a conversation. Some about work, some about life, some about sports, some about what shared interest. And that was that like glass ceiling break moment where I no longer was just the boss. I was part of the team, and I think they recognized I had their back. And so really the first aspect was to kind of gain some of that mutual trust and collaboration. And then you got to go get that IT win. And I think then when I got that IT win was okay, we trust this guy. He knows his stuff. We're going to be all right. So for 2 years, spent a lot of time there really putting best practice into place for a group that had no direction, right? It was this black box. Ideas went to die, and we upped the game quite a bit. We built an on-premise data center, brought our infrastructure in from IT, because obviously with that consolidation, they no longer wanted to manage our stuff. And so we really built something pretty solid. About 2 years into that, I had an opportunity to come to higher ed. So that was kind of by accident, if you will, came into higher ed and was the director of the business system. So I led up an IT team within finance, and that over the years grew into the director of enterprise systems, where you had these quasi-IT silos and the registrar's office and financial aid and HR all came together under my leadership, and we moved into IT. And so I think that is where did that. So I was at the college for about 8.5 years. That was the last year and a half. And, you know, I had ambitions. I wanted to be a CIO. And so I had an opportunity to go back to local government and be the, you know, head of IT for a suburb of Tucson, the town of Marana. And, you know, based on wherever my career goes, I'm going to say that was, that will always be something I will look back on fondly, because they gave me that chance and a real opportunity, I think, to prove myself, to come in, lead a team through the pandemic. Once again, small organization, staff of about 20, no real direction, no best practice. I walked in, the town had 25 megabits of internet, right? 25 megabits of internet. Had we not fixed a few things in the year leading up to the pandemic, we wouldn't have made it through. And so it was a great experience. I mean, it was thrown to the fire. You know, like I said, software developer by trade. I was having to help stand up infrastructure. I had to help stand up the new network. I mean, all of these things wasn't my background, but it was my responsibility. And so was there for 3.5 years. And then I had an opportunity to come back to the college. My previous boss left to Oklahoma State, and a lot of people reached out, hey, you got to come back. You got to come back. And so I had this opportunity to come back to higher ed. What really drew me back was the purpose, right? And I talked about that earlier, that transformed lives through affordable education. What I didn't have at the town Marana was a purpose, right? I knew what we did. I knew how we did it, but I didn't have that deep why. And that's what really brought me back to the college, was that passion for the college's why. And, you know, been here almost back 2 years now, and it's been great. It's been a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to have a big team. It means you don't have to do everything, but I still get quite involved in some areas, and we are going through this major shift in higher ed. You know, I think actually a big shift in the world in terms of technology. We're at the early stages of, I think, the next revolution, the autonomy revolution with AI. And so it's exciting. We're doing a lot of big stuff, really trying to set the stage for what this college is going to be in the future from a technology standpoint. And I think in the world of AI, the world of autonomy, and the world where for the first time ever, the 18 to 24 population is going to start falling off the cliff here next year. And so we're going to be in a situation where no one's going to ask us to do less, but we are going to have to do more with less. We're going to have less students. We're going to have a smaller workforce. And so this is really where I think AI has a lot of potential to close gaps. Now, there's a lot of gimmicky stuff out there, and so that's where you have to be careful, but I think there is a lot of potential to close some gaps. Yeah.
I think that one of the interesting things about that, you talk about 1824, so there's my generation, right? The baby boomers, right? You know, they talk about the World War I and World War II people, but the baby boomers really was, in my opinion, the most significant generation, because we did so much. We created so much in our generation. And unfortunately, the younger generation no longer sees us as valid, right? So they want to push us out the way and get rid of us and move on. And I think a lot of these new technologies are giving them license to see the no longer the need for us. But what I think what's different about the younger generations and the older generations, we saw a need to document. We're less risky. Your generation is riskier. You believe in taking chances. We were risk averse. You know, we weren't big. You know, we believed in redundancy. We believed in finding ways to minimize, you know, ourselves at risk. That's why ransomware is so prevalent, because you guys don't believe in closing your holes, you know.
I do. I very much believe in closing my holes.
You know, we left a few back doors, but you guys just open the front door and open the back door and say, have at it, you know. So You know, the thing about cybersecurity, you talk about your search for a CISO, we didn't have a CISO because we didn't leave the door open to have security gaps like that, and I think that what AI and, Drew and I talk about this a lot, so there was just, narrow AI and we're at generative AI, and, there's just strong and IBM calls it super AI, whatever the words are, there is the way we're developing things, and I don't want to get in my horse and Drew pull in the reins, but the way we see race and gender and age and all these things in technology, there's so many holes that we haven't really thought through. We're still, and this is one of my favorite people. I pick on Google and Microsoft all the time. They do such poor jobs when it comes to race and the things that matter, right? So Google's face first attempt at facial recognition, they put up a gorilla. What in the real world? You mean, and I say this all the time, Google's not stupid. They didn't do this intentionally. They just had people who were not educated in race developing these things. And you still have these problems today. We haven't really come to the table. So will AI fix these problems? No, because bias is baked in everything. Drew and I talked about this today. Remember the language, you had slave and master. These were terms in AI, I mean, in technology. We haven't really made great strides at this. We still have the majority of people who are developing cybersecurity stuff being white and male, So you're going to have problems with this. So when you think about the work that you're doing, Isaac, and I'm going to let Drew get his two cents in here in a second, but do you think when you think about the work that you're doing and your team is doing, how do you plan for these small thought processes that people bring to the table when they're developing these things?
So 100%, couldn't agree with you more. I don't think AI is the end all be all. AI is a tool, no different than any other tool. And tools have strengths and tools have limitations. One thing we talk about quite a bit on the AI working group here at the college are those limitations, right? And the biases and the inequities and all that kind of stuff. And so as we are putting together strategies for usage of AI, guidelines around AI, we are definitely taking all of that stuff into account because it is, once again, it is not a silver bullet. It is not magic. I was in a presentation the other day and someone said it best. AI is a stochastic parrot, right? It is a predictive model that just repeats stuff. And it never is going to say, I don't know, right? That's probably one of the biggest downsides is, like a human, hey, what is XYZ? I don't know. AI is not going to say that. It is going to use a predictive model to come up what it predicts to be what it thinks should be the answer. People have to be, cognizant of that. They have to be aware that, you cannot trust it 100%. I'll give you an example of where I had an employee really make a mistake using it. But the intentions were right, but it was a great learning experience. Faculty member reached out, had a complaint. The staff member decided, hey, I'm going to use ChatGPT to write a response. So this is, someone at the service desk didn't proof it, right?
Right.
And then the response had things like, I know you're emotional, and this was to a female staff member, and right, it was like, oh,
Exactly.
he never would have wrote this himself, right? And that's where you have to be careful. And the whole idea, he wanted to convey a message that had emotion did not mean to be like, I'm accusing you of being emotional. And that's where we have to be careful, right? And once again, what is the source of the data that it's being trained on? Are you relying on ChatGPT? Are you relying on a closed source? I mean, a whole lot of this is going to come down to what data was used to be trained on. Because once again, people are biased. By nature, people are biased. Therefore, they are creating models that are biased. Therefore, the data is biased. So once again, you just have to be aware of it, right? No different than if you're doing a Google search today, you have to know that there's some biases in that as well. So once again, there's a lot there. It's a big topic. But I do want to circle back to your conversation about the baby boomers and the fact that the baby boomers didn't take risk and the next generation takes a lot of
Less risk, not didn't take
risk. Okay, yeah,
less risk.
less risk. Fair, fair. I think, you know, I read a really good book, and I'm trying to think. I think this was Simon Sinek's Leaders Eat Last, I believe. It could have been Let's Start With Why, but one of his books, and he talks about, so if you think about leading up to World War I was the Roaring Twenties. I would argue that was more like it is today, take more risk. Then you have the, you know, it all falls off the table, which then means the baby boomers are definitely going to take less risk because the generation before is the Great Depression and all that kind of stuff. Baby boomers build it back up to the 80s, the great wealth. So then my generation comes and things are great. So therefore risk for us is definitely different than risk from the generation before. So I think it's all cyclical, right? And it all kind of has to do, if you grow up in a very safe environment, you're more willing to take risk. If you grow up in an environment that wasn't safe, you're going to be less willing to take risk. You know, once again, there'll be another crash, another cycle, and it's all cyclical, but I 100% agree with you,
but I think that you are, like, we were playing with pennies. You're playing with diamonds.
Well,
you
know?
So we had less to risk.
Yeah.
You have everything to risk because look at the world that you're in, right? Look at what's happening in Israel. Look at what's happening with Ukraine. Yeah. You know, you're playing in a world with everything. We were playing with very little.
Yeah, very different world. Right.
So
it's like cyclical and upward, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. You know, because, you know, your elections, you know, whether 2020 was a fluke or not, I don't know. But, you know, you're playing with a whole lot more than we were playing with, you know.
Very, very true.
You know, Drew, you know, you're constantly in this battle trying to make sure you're keeping things secure, you know, maintaining your data and all that stuff. So you know more about this. I've been out of the loop now for how many years? 2 or 3 years now. So I'm not in that fire anymore. I'm more of a consultant on the outside looking in. So you know more about this.
You're still pretty tight in there, Rochelle. Like you're tighter in there than most people, I think.
Yeah, I'm still window dressing.
Isaac, I was curious about, you mentioned like not having a lot of turnover on the last few years. Like, how do you I don't want to say encourage people not to leave, but like, how do you keep people around? Like, one of the things we talk about a lot of times is when you lose good people, like it's really hard to replace good people. And like, how do you manage that? Like, how do you keep that turnover low?
Yeah, I mean, I there's no way I'm going to take full credit for that at all. So I'm not going to tell you what I have done. I will tell you what has historically been here and some big wins. And then, you know, I think part of it gets to the culture we're trying to create. So one, there's been a really good, now I say there's not a lot of turnover. There is more turnover at the entry level, our part-time service desk assistants, but that's by design. And so what we've created is this really grow them up, right? Grow up. So bring in some part-time service desk staff, train them up. Then, you know, when there's opportunities for boots on the ground, permanent frontline staff, we don't have to hire from the outside. We've created this natural pipeline in almost all of our units of IT. So in security, in infrastructure, we have people who have grown up through that program and have now moved on to bigger roles. So we've really focused, you know, this year it was kind of, you got to buy talent or you got to grow talent. We were having a hard time buying it. So we put emphasis into trying to grow it. I think our chief technology officer, Jack Satterfield, has done an amazing job. He comes from the private sector. And he came to the college during when I was away. And he has brought a very different mindset, a very corporate mindset. He's brought some people over from the private sector. And the things he is doing and the things together as a team we've been able to accomplish, I think are very forward thinking for higher ed, right? We are, I'm not going to call us on the bleeding edge of things, but we are definitely, we operate more from a corporate mindset than definitely a traditional higher ed mindset, which I think people have gravitated toward, right? It's an opportunity to learn, do some things like they do in the corporate world and potentially grow your skill set. So I think that has attracted people. The college as a whole did a class and comp study a couple of years ago. So really, you know, fixed a lot of the salaries. And so I think you bring all those things together. I think it's created a fun environment, a competitive environment, and an environment where people can grow and thrive. And I think that has ultimately contributed to keeping people. The hope is that we are able to maintain all three of those things, because I think it's all three of them that are keeping people here.
Nice. How has HR supported you in that? Because you can't do that without support of HR.
Yeah, I mean, HR was obviously instrumental in the class and comp study. So that I would say that is the big support from HR was on the compensation piece. I think inside of IT is where we've had to create that culture, right? Really create that culture, create those expectations. Obviously, finance plays a role in, giving us a budget. But the interesting thing is as we've, flipped over systems, brought in newer and improved systems, we've actually cut costs. That's the part that I think is the most mind-blowing. I was having a conversation with Jack yesterday. We just flipped over our phone system. So we went from an Avaya phone system to Cisco cloud calling. And total, on average, we're going to be saving like a couple hundred thousand dollars a year over year
Wow.
by making that change. And we have a better phone system that has better soft phone capabilities and is better set for the workforce today. So, and those things are fun. They're exciting. And, I tell the staff, I'm gonna push you to work hard. I'm gonna challenge you to work hard, but we're gonna have fun while we're doing it. And I think, we're doing a lot, but it's fun. And when you get to see the benefits, that's, we all win. And so I really think it's a multifaceted approach for sure.
Do your people work in-house or do they work remotely?
So mostly remote. So if you are front facing, so if you are supporting staff front facing and you're supervising front facing staff, you are in the office. Outside of that, it's to the discretion of your supervisory chain. Most back office staff are remote. Now they're in town, right? So the college hat is pretty strict on, at minimum, you need to be in Arizona. We do have, I don't know, a few dozen staff out of the state, not in IT. In IT, everybody's within the state of Arizona. Nearly, I'm going to say the high 90s, like 99% are actually in Tucson. So, but yes, the college has embraced remote work. Obviously, the pandemic showed it works. The college was mostly closed for 2 years. I mean, we were teaching classes, but facilities were closed for the better part of 2 years. And so, yeah.
That is one of the things that prior to COVID, most organizations were steadfast that remote work did not work. People were going to shortchange and they're going to be cutting corners. People were not, and what everything has proved that you get more work out of people when they work remotely. You have to tell people to turn the phone off, go to bed, the computer, because people are really dedicated in work and work. I mean, of course you have slackers, but
Yeah,
for
of
the
course.
majority, most people work hard, even remotely.
I think 100% you hit the nail on the head. Most people work hard. My fear is that the people who don't are going to ruin it for everybody else. I mean, you're seeing it already, right? Big companies are pulling people back in. And, we just finally actually formalized our work from home plan. Even though it was like, I would argue, relatively working for the better part of now, like 4 years, we formalized it. And I think that formalization of it is, it's not going to be smooth. It is going to bring, I think, challenges, which, I was talking to the chancellor the other day, clarifying some things because, at some point, enough's going to be enough. And the chancellor's going to be like, this is not worth the headache, everybody back. Which then will then create a different impact in the reverse, right? You'll have good people leave because it's like, well, and so it's tricky. It is a very tricky one. I try to split my time. Like, I'm in the office today, so I try to split my time. I think there's a healthy balance. But I mean, I'm sitting here today in a building. The entire floor is empty. I think I'm the only person up here. So it's yeah, very different world.
Duke did a study in 2009. I think it's been a while. And this was pre-COVID. They found that I think it was like something like 17% of their staff work, do the majority of the work. I think it was like 33, 34% did, and I'm talking of their work. In other words, not work, but like did what was required of them. The bare did good. The rest were slackers. They come in, they turn on their computer on Facebook, social, they go to the bathroom, they're around the cooler. And this was pre-COVID. So that small number did above and beyond. They're really putting in work. That mid-level number are just doing what it takes to get by. And then that larger number, but the way the systems are designed, it's hard to fire somebody. It's really hard to
It
fire
is.
somebody. So it doesn't make any difference whether they're working remote, whether they're in the building. You have what you have in terms of work. You know who your good employees are. You know who the people who are doing the bare minimum. And then you know who your slackers are. So, and so what you said, you know, they're going to turn the apple cart upside down and you're going to lose your good people. You're going to make them come back to the office. But I think what remote working has done is cut down on the carbon footprint because people aren't driving up and down the hard highway wasting gas, right? You don't have as many traffic nightmares. People have car accidents, killing themselves, going back and forth, wasting time in the car and traffic. But, you know, you reduce the number of buildings, electricity, and lots of, so there are a lot of positives to that. You know, you have more happier employees who are happy because they're at home, they can work and spend time with their family, whatever, you know. But we still have this argument about remote work. And I have written a gazillion articles about this, you know, and nobody's listening to me. But I think exactly what you have, when people make their employees come back to work, they're going to lose those employees because they're going to be a tremendous number of companies. They're going to let people work remotely. Higher ed is going to be stuck in the middle because they're going to get this bonehead idea. Oh, we need to bring all our employees back into the office. And you're going to lose those good employees to corporations that allow their employees to work remotely.
It's a supervisory issue. Right. Yeah. 100%. It's a super, like when I was at the town of Marana, they did not believe in remote work at all. I think during the pandemic, we were home for 2 months. Like, that's it. So it was, I think, March to May of 2020. And so, I mean, we were told we were cowards for being directors and we had offices. Why should we be at home? And, you know, so they did not embrace it. They begrudgingly kind of allowed a little bit. And the town manager said, it's like, well, there's no accountability. I was like, well, then fix the supervisors. That's a supervisory issue. It's not a where the person works from issue. If you have people not taking holding their people accountable, you have a leadership issue. Fix that issue. You know, once again, what's easier? Deal with the hard work or make the easy decision of everybody come back.
Come in.
That's the quick and easy decision, but it will have lasting negative impacts for
sure.
Yes,
it will. For sure. Yes, it will. You know, but higher ed is stuck in that thing because the instructor has to come into the college and teach the student. You have a lot of instructors who are, you know, who are not comfortable with technology. You know, Zoom was like a nightmare when oh my God, you know, faculty who couldn't figure out how to use it or weren't comfortable using it. You could think of another, you know, so you've got this thing where, you know, how do you fix what you need versus what's best for you? You know, it is what it is. Okay. We don't want to waste all our time on that because we could wax ad nauseum on that. So let's move on from that. So where do you see, just with what you've been able to, and it sounds impressive what you've been able to accomplish, Isaac. I mean, like, you know, great work, you know, really impressive. So
amazing career. Like, it was a really cool, like, history of everything that you've done.
Yeah. Absolutely. We can't wait to see what you're going to do next. You know, when are you writing the book? You know, we have to buy a copy. You know, let us know. But so where do you see your career going from here? So what's next for Isaac?
Man, that's a great question. I find myself having that conversation with people way more often than I would have ever expected.
That's a good question, though. That's a good problem to have.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if I know 100%. I mean, I love what I do, but I've always, you know, my mom said this to my wife when I was coming back. I was like, oh, I'm going to be there and retire. And my mom's like, no, he won't. You know, he'll get bored and move on. And I don't know if bored's the right word because it's never a boring day. But I have always been one to challenge myself. From young age all the way. So I don't know. I mean, I really... You know, I plan to be here, you know, at least 3-4 more years. I'm passionate about this institution. I'm passionate what we are doing. And I want to see that to some level of what I would call completion. I don't know what that is. I want to do X. But at some ways, as you know, I mature in my career, you know, what is the next step? And I've never worked in the private sector, but that is a challenge. And I think that is something at some point in my career I would love to do. It comes with different challenges, but it also comes with different opportunities. And in
the pay is better.
Well, you know, like I said, different opportunities.
The pay is better. That's the top button on the list. The pay is better.
That is a big one. I also, you know, you talked about a little while ago when you said, you know, it's hard to get rid of bad people in
politics. Really is.
It is It's like pulling teeth, right? I mean,
in the private sector, they fire you the same day. Welcome, you're
right?
walking to the
And
door
like I
with the
said,
security guard.
It's a different challenge, but it's a different opportunity. And there are times when we have been extremely frustrated and hand-tied by those situations. And you just think about, man, what if? Like, could you imagine what we could do if we could move on from that and not spend weeks, months, years dealing with it? So honestly, I think that is that will be the next phase. When it will come, I don't know, but I think that is the next phase. I'll say this, as a Black man in America, as a Black executive in America, I don't do this just for me, right? I can't do it just for me. One of my former bosses said this when I was leaving to go to the town of Marana, and he was Indian. And he said, do you know why children in India have pictures of Michael Jordan on their wall? And I was like, well, gosh, every kid in the 90s had a picture of Michael Jordan on their wall. He said, because nobody in India has been in the NBA. He said, go be that picture on the wall for your family and your girls. And I carry that with me very deeply, right? We were talking about elections. You know, one thing Obama did is he proved anybody could make it to the White House.
Wait a minute now.
Anybody, well, I, okay, fair enough. I got to be careful here. He proved that any male at least could make it to the White House.
And so, any qualified.
No, but what I mean is 100%. But what I mean is before that was you had to be a white male, qualified or not, to make it to the White House. Obama proved for all Black men, Black boys, that was something you could aspire to be. As a qualified Black person, you could make it to the White House. And so I looked at for myself, seeing is believing, seeing is achieving. And so I feel that, on that journey, I carry more than just something for myself. I carry it for everyone that comes behind me who looks like me and has ambitions like me. And I hold that near and dear.
Amen. But let me just tell you briefly my little bit of my story. This is, I'll be really, Drew has heard this so much he could tell you for me. So I got accepted to Columbia. Mm-hmm. I'm walking onto the school in 1976. You weren't even born yet. 1976.
I was not.
I'm walking to matriculate. It's a white man standing there with pamphlets and a little table out there. And he says, as I'm walking by, he says, we're trying to bring Negroes into computing. 1976. I don't know what a Negro is, and I don't know what computing is, because where I grew up, they used the other N-word, and I never heard of computing.
Yep.
So I just kept walking. And he yells, and I'll pay you $30,000. Columbia who?
Yep.
I went that way. Mm-hmm. Never looked back. I didn't get my first college degree until I was 42.
Mm-hmm.
That's my career into computing. And I have done my work in this for the people that look like me.
There you go.
I'm not Obama, but mm-hmm. I'm a Black woman.
There you go.
In my whole career, there have been few of us, along the way.
Yep.
And this podcast and all the work that I do is for people who look like me.
I appreciate it.
Every single day, what we do,
mm-hmm.
you and I, Drew, all of us, we do for people who look like us to open the door. Because 100%. If we don't, who will?
There you go. That's it.
So, okay, we're running out of time. We got maybe how much time we got, Drew?
We probably got another 5 or 6 minutes.
AI. Talk about AI, Drew.
Yeah, so I'm very curious how you see like AI changing pretty much like colleges in the future. I know we talked a little bit about like it may make certain things easier and sort of like easier to like tighten the belt around now that we have AI to fill in some of those gaps. But like, where else do you see it going?
Yeah, so I'll start with like the low-hanging fruit, where we've been using it in a lot of ways that are not like the popular generative AI. In security. So go back a little over a year, had a massive fraud issue at the college, right? As a open institution, no barrier to entry, you are ripe for exploitation. And so we had a massive fraud issue, and this is where we were to leverage third party and really analytics, right? So not flashy AI, but 100% using AI to go and determine, is this student fraudulent or not before we let them into our system. So that was one of the big areas. And when I talk about AI, I use that example and get people thinking like, oh, wow, it's not ChatGPT, but it's very powerful. Insecurity, right? So machine learning, that is a big use case. You know, we have anomalous detection where it is learning our network. And then when things happen that are weird, it takes action, right? These are things, sure, I could have a staff of 100 SOC analysts sitting there trying to analyze all the traffic and then come up with some decision that's not feasible. So I think that is some of the low-hanging fruit areas where we've got into it. But really where I see the next iteration is really that generative piece to augment the workforce. As I've talked about, you know, here in the next few years, the workforce, I don't know if the workforce gets smaller, but the population to draw from will get smaller. And we're going to have to be able to do more with less. Perfect example, we were looking at a tool for our application suite. And ultimately, what it will allow recruiters to do is use generative AI to build recruitment campaigns, right? Then they can tweak them, they can make changes, but what would have taken hours or days to try to, you know, put together, grab populations and put together a recruitment campaign, a 1 minute chat conversation can do. And so I think that's where you're gonna start seeing, I think you're gonna see it hit back office first. I'm on a group right now where it's a lot of faculty talking about how does this impact the classroom? And I think we're still at a lot of discussion and a lot of this is cool and a lot of this is neat. I think on the administrative side is where we're going to be able to take action first, because I think there's just more applicable use cases. And so once again, I think it's going to be a tool that's going to be able to augment the workforce, allow us to do more with less, potentially do more than we're doing now, and really just take us to that next level. Do I think it's magic? Do I think it's the game changer? No, but I do think it is a revolutionary change, 100%.
It really is. I found myself using it to make logos for software projects,
right, there you go.
Which is
yeah.
Like not a skill I have, but like it makes it so quick and easy. It's like, oh, now this sort of looks halfway pretty.
Yep.
I think that AI is what we need, but I don't think we need to allow it to control everything.
100%.
People are just throwing everything at it. You know, people are just saying, here's what you said about the help desk. I can't tell you how many organizations are using it as a help desk answer. So you have a problem, let it answer the help desk problem. I can't find my message in my email, so let ChatGPT or something answer the problem. And they end up, what you just said, with some mistaken response to it without actually having someone peruse it before they send the response. So I think that's really a problem.
Yeah, definitely have to be careful with it. Just like any technology. I mean, it'd be no different, you know, in the 90s when the internet became a thing, right? It's with all this stuff, you have to leverage it to your business's capabilities and as a tool, right? There is no set it and forget it. There's no such thing. But I think once again, a powerful tool and will create monumental changes.
Yeah. I think people think it can replace people. Drew and I talk about this a lot. People think it's going to come in and replace things.
The best quote I heard around that is AI is not going to replace your job, but somebody who knows how to use AI may replace your job, right? So it's a new era of upskilling, right? Just like when the internet came, people had to learn in the personal computer, people had to upskill. Yes, it will change where people work and how they work, but it's not going to eliminate people.
At least not right away. You know, I Drew and I just talked about this. You're too young to know who this is, but there used to be a cartoon called The Jetsons.
I remember The Jetsons.
Anything about it? You're still too young. But anyway, Rosie.
Yep.
If you know about
robot, Rosie, yeah, I know The Jetsons.
Strong AI is Rosie.
Yeah, and I mean, we're not there yet, right?
We're not there yet. No, right. We're not there yet, but it's coming. It's coming, you know.
Possibly.
It's coming. The question is, what will it do?
Yeah.
You know, so that's what, you know, all of this is what will it do? And if it gets into the wrong hands,
it's already there, right? I mean, that you want to talk about security. Yes, we can use it to defend. Bad guys can use it to attack. And so, it's the world we're in.
Phishing attacks are getting exponentially better with all the
of course
AI. So.
Yep.
And that's your generation's not closing all your loopholes.
Well,
I'm just saying, you need some baby boomers in your life.
There you go. There you go. We need some baby boomer consultants.
Exactly,
There
hire them.
you Thank
Thank you
go.
so much, Isaac. I'm so glad
Thank you.
you talked to
Yeah,
us.
no,
I
this
hope
is
you
great.
come back and talk to us again. We
Oh,
loved
for
it.
sure. Anytime. This was great. I
Wonderful.
really
So
appreciate it.
wonderful. Yeah,
Appreciate
thank
it.
you
Thank
so
you
much.
very much. Take care. Have a great rest of the day. We'll definitely chat soon.
I appreciate that so
Awesome.
much. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're
Thank you
welcome.
so much.
Bye-bye.